I think the reality is that many people will have slightly different decisions to make, and many people, I think, will be finding that economic opportunities are beginning to open up for them that weren't there when we introduced the universal credit uplift.
That was Annabel Goldie, and we'll hear more from her later in the show. Hello and welcome to The Stooshie, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Andy Phillip, and on this episode, I'll be joined by Adele Merson and Derek Healy to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read by Morag Lindsay.
Almost 430,000 Scots have been unable to pay their council tax bills after running out of cash, according to new research. Polling for the charity Citizens Advice Scotland found that in the last year, almost a third of people had run out of money before the date when they received their wages or pension or benefit payments. Footballer Marcus Rashford said it felt bittersweet to be collecting an honorary degree for tackling child poverty the day after the universal credit uplift was retracted. The England player used a speech at the University of Manchester ceremony at Old Trafford to highlight the impact of the government's cut on millions of families across the UK. At 23 years old, the footballer turned food poverty campaigner became the youngest recipient of an honorary doctorate from the university. Stirling is among eight areas still in the running to become UK City of Culture in 2025. The remaining bidders will be given £40,000 to continue their campaigns. No other bid from Scotland made it onto the long list.
Thank you, Morag. Now, the week started with a familiar sound of bluster, gags and ruffled hair. No, it wasn't your uncle at the after-dinner speech. It was the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom geeing up his Tory support. Over 45 minutes, he did his best Boris Johnson impression, and I'm gathered here with my panel of experts to decide and determine whether or not we actually heard anything of substance or whether it was all style. Adele, was it just me or did the Conservative leader forget to mention any policy?
Yeah, I think there was actually one policy mentioned, and that was pretty much a speech devoid of any real substantive material. It was just him sort of... can you call them jokes? I don't know. Trying to make jokes anyway. And there was a lot of bluster. I mean, I noticed the BBC actually had to do a kind of fact check style article of his speech. So I think that shows you what kind of a speech it was.
Well, I read a lot of hot takes from pundits saying it was great and it was a laugh a minute, you know, the kind of thing that the public... the idea that maybe the public forgive a lot of Boris Johnson's character or persona, as if it doesn't really matter, you know, that there's, despite all the chaos around, it's fine, Boris was being Boris. I'm not sure that people subscribe to that opinion quite as much as some in the lobby might think. I'm just wondering, Derek, did you think it was a serious attempt to grapple with problems that have been stored up, you know, on his watch and, you know, previous governments? Or was it more just style, the kind of thing that you expect in a party conference when you're surrounded by your supporters and you just want everyone to get along, basically, and into Christmas when things are going to get a bit tough?
I think he was definitely playing to the kind of party faithful, wasn't he? There was plenty of jokes. As you say, some of them were funnier than others. I think there was some funny ones, to be fair to him, but a lot of them, I don't know if they quite made the mark. But I think, you know, if you're going to do all these jokes at a time where, I mean, if you look around the country just now, we've got, you know, the energy crisis, we've got shortages of food on shelves, we've got the army helping the ambulance service, we've got the army being drafted in to try and get fuel into pumps, and you know, you've got a country that's been absolutely devastated by COVID, both in terms of the deaths and in terms of economically it's been devastated as well. So to stand up, it was a real opportunity for him to show proper leadership and really set out what he was going to do. And instead of that, it was kind of jokes about Ian Blackford's Croft and, you know, and you having a few pops at Keir Starmer, which were pretty easy pops to make, weren't they, really, and Jeremy Corbyn and so on. You know, I think... It seemed to play well with the people who were in the audience in the room, but I wonder how many people maybe watching it on the news or reading our coverage of it will think, well, where's the substance? You know, what are you actually going to do to get us out of the kind of mess that we're in?
Well, there was one thing that was conspicuous by its absence, and it's something that the Conservatives, particularly in Scotland, have been speaking about an incredible amount recently, and that is the SNP and independence and the prospect of another referendum. Recent reports have kind of suggested that there's a new tack where, you know, just don't mention independence. Because there was a feeling among some advisors that it was just playing into the SNP's hands. But I mean, he certainly stuck to that rule. He didn't mention independence once. He mentioned Ian Blackford once to poke fun at him. He mentioned really Scotland only once, and it was to do with infrastructure. Adele, you have been writing about the tension between the Scottish and UK governments recently, particularly road projects like the A9, the A96, and there's other ones like running across the south of Scotland in Alistair Jack, the Scottish Secretary's backyard. There was a suggestion that the UK government is looking at these projects, which are in the control of the Scottish Parliament, and thinking that they can maybe put their stamp on them. Is that something that's building up for a bit of a showdown down the line, or is it just a way of having a go at the SNP in the conference setting?
No, I think you're right that they're not wanting to so openly speak about independence, but perhaps their strategy is instead to look at certain areas where they can act and, I guess, gain favour with people, such as you've mentioned there. There is this kind of ongoing, I guess, dispute around the A96 in particular, whether it's going to be fully duelled between Inverness and Inverurie. And the Tory MP Andrew Bowie had written to the Transport Secretary Grant Shapps asking if he would sort of intervene if need be, and they gave a bit of a, it wasn't really a response on either side. It was left quite open, like, this is a devolved issue, but we always look at kind of projects that benefit the whole UK. And then also this week you've seen it in other areas, such as this ongoing row over Freeports, and that's another issue where we see the UK and Aberdeen City Council leader actually went down and met Michael Gove and made clear to him, like, we're willing to work with the UK government. You guys have a lot of the financial levers and we're keen for this project to happen. So that's another area where you've got that kind of conflict. And also this new levelling up fund, which I know, again, Aberdeen City Council has made approaches to get the UK government to fund. It's a sort of international market that Aberdeen City Council is wanting to set up in the city. So these are just, you know, just in the last week, that's three different projects where we can see the UK government are trying to act, and we may see, particularly around roads, a bit of a conflict between Holyrood and Westminster on that.
One area that the UK government has been acting across the whole of the UK is on using the military to plug gaps in our overstretched and under pressure health service, and getting petrol to the pumps and things like this. Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland also had to make a request to the Ministry of Defence to get military personnel to help out here. What does that say about the government at Westminster and in Holyrood? I mean, Derek, does it show that we're just in unprecedented times and we just have no option but to call on the support of soldiers? Or are we seeing a kind of a failure of government?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I've been speaking to union leaders this week, particularly about the ambulance crisis. And they've been telling me that this is not just a problem with, you know, that's just been created by COVID. In effect, COVID has been used as a sort of convenient excuse for some of the problems we've been seeing. If you look at the ambulance issue in particular, a big part of the problem there is that ambulances are showing up and they're having to wait really long times. You know, they're having to wait maybe 90 minutes sometimes to try and offload their patients and get them seen. Those problems aren't being created by COVID alone. You know, they're being created by a shortage of beds and a shortage of staff. They're being exacerbated by COVID, definitely. But they're long-term problems that have been created by, you know, a lack of funding, by mismanagement maybe. With a lot of the different issues we're seeing right across the UK, the shortage of HGV drivers, for example, Brexit is playing a massive role, but it's not politically expedient for people to say that sometimes. You know, the energy issue is an issue we're seeing right around the world, but Brexit has made it worse in the UK because there are all sorts of issues with storage here now. So a lot of these are weaknesses that have been building up over years and years. It's a failure of government. You know, and I think it's disingenuous for politicians to pretend that it's a short-term issue just being brought on by, you know, a pandemic or any other individual cause, when actually there are far deeper problems there.
Well, that brings us neatly to our familiar name, Annabel Goldie, who was, as you will all remember, she was the Scottish Conservative leader who was in post when Alex Salmond was First Minister. She was an MSP in the West of Scotland, subsequently became Baroness Annabel Goldie and is a minister in the UK government for defence. She was in Lookers, RAF base in Fife, earlier this week. Our reporter Rachel Amory went along to Lookers for a chat earlier this week. She began by asking, is having the army driving ambulances and HGVs the best use of the military?
Well, our military have a primary obligation, and that is that they have to protect the United Kingdom both internationally and nationally. They are our security protection force. They keep us safe. They do that, sorry, frog in my throat, they do that 24/7. But they also have another important role, which is if challenge confronts us internally, domestically, within the United Kingdom, they have a role to perform in helping us out with that. Now, the challenge can be anything. It could be flooding, or it could, as we have seen, be the COVID pandemic, which has been such a horrific experience for us all. And I think what the military have demonstrated is this extraordinary capacity with their particular skills. You know, the military exists to recognise a problem, to analyse the problem, to work out a solution, and then deliver the solution. And by golly, they do that in spades. And I have seen that at first hand as they encountered these difficult challenges put forward by COVID, whether that was how do we have enough testing units? How do we have a vaccination programme rolled out? Are we short of ambulances? Do we need help with ambulance drivers? In come the military, analyse the problem, work out how to fix it, and deliver on that. And so they will do that, and they do it superbly, and we owe them a huge thanks for the tremendous contribution they've made on that front. But that is never with prejudice to their fundamental obligation to protect the country and keep us safe. And strategic planning at headquarters ensures that that is properly balanced. So we actually get the best of both worlds. They keep us safe with all their operational activity, their skills, their expertise, and also when called upon, they come to our aid throughout our communities, the length and breadth of the UK. And I can tell you from the public reaction, are they welcome? They get a terrific reaction. They're regarded with huge affection, and quite rightly so.
If we could move away from sort of defence for a while, the Conservative Party donor Malcolm Offord, he's been offered a peerage in the Scotland office. Now, he stood for Holyrood and didn't win a seat. So why is someone who the public said no to at the ballot box now coming into the Scotland office?
Well, there are many people who go into the House of Lords. I'm one of them. And people might well ask the question, what's she doing there? So, you know, I don't think it's for any of us to speculate on why people are there. I'm delighted to see someone from Scotland with Malcolm Offord's achievements within Scotland being recognised. And I think he'll be a very useful addition to the ministerial staff in the Scotland office.
There's plenty of MPs that could have been chosen from the Commons. I mean, there's Andrew Bowie or David Duckett. Why not one of them?
Well, I'm not in charge of these appointments, and I am a much too unimportant person to offer any useful comment on these matters. That's for the Prime Minister's decision. Now, he has taken a decision that he thinks Malcolm can bring value to the Scotland office. I think he has got a very established reputation in Scotland, and I think he will add value to what we're doing within the Scotland office.
And recently, Douglas Ross has also said the Conservative Party is the party of the working people. How is that?
well, how could it not be that? I mean, traditionally, the Conservatives, as one nation, Conservatives, a one nation party, have been the party to represent people of all backgrounds, from wherever they come, but very, very importantly, to be the party to give opportunity to people from all backgrounds, to make sure they get a decent education, to make sure that they have a functioning economy where they can get jobs or become self-employed, found their own businesses. What we believe in is that every individual has a capacity, a capability, and we're the party that exists to encourage that and to let people have the opportunity to maximise what they can achieve and not use the forces of state to interfere with that or to intervene in that.
I know you say that you are the party of working people, but obviously the universal credit has just, the £20 uplift has just been taken away. So how can you justify that when you say that the party of the working class as well?
Well, the welfare system exists in many forms, and part of that is universal credit. And I think many people acknowledge that that was one of the most important changes that was ever made to our system of welfare support, because it allows the flexibility of people being able to work, get into the jobs market and not be penalised for doing that, still getting support from the benefit system. That's absolutely right. What we saw with COVID was a quite extraordinary economic impact in the UK. And the government responded, in my opinion, absolutely rightly, by saying, we're going to have to support the economy, we're going to have to support jobs. And they weighed in and did that with furlough schemes, with other forms of support for businesses, to ensure that people had some sense of where they might go once COVID began to recede. Now, part of that was to offer an uplift in universal credit to see people over that immediate and, for many of us, unpredictable hurdle. But where we are now is the economy is once again functioning. We are growing our economy very healthily in comparison with other G7 countries doing that well. So our focus is on creating jobs. Our focus is ensuring that these opportunities that we want people to have actually open up in front of them, and they are there to take hold of them and benefit from them. And universal credit has always been a level of support to try and ensure that whether people are not in work or whether they're in work but need help, that they get that additional level of support. The uplift was temporary for a very specific reason. It's being withdrawn, but that's not to say that people won't have other places to turn to. Now, for example, there's the Household Support Fund. That's a massive amount of money, and that will reach out over the United Kingdom. I understand that Scotland's share of that is £41 million. That's the Barnett consequential, is my understanding. And that means that it will be for the Scottish Government to determine how it applies that money. But you need to direct your questions to them as to how they wish to do that. But the bottom line is that we are providing a secure economic basis for the whole United Kingdom to go forward. We're concentrating on jobs creation. And for those that hit crisis, and sadly people do hit periods of crisis, there are other interventions. My one bit of advice to anyone who finds it hard is, look, there are people there to help. There are people there to help in your job centres and your local authorities. Go and seek the help. And there will be guidance available to them so that no one is left without some sense of where they can try and get support and guidance for where they should be going.
And so a lot of people who we've spoken to who might be struggling now with this uplift gone, one of the problems in the winter is going to be whether to heat or eat. And if that was you in that situation, like, how would you make that decision as to whether you put heating on or get food on the table?
Well, that is a very stark choice, and it sounds horrendous. I think the reality is that many people will have slightly different decisions to make, and many people, I think, will be finding that economic opportunities are beginning to open up for them that weren't there when we introduced the universal credit uplift. And that's why we introduced it, so that there was some form of support when nothing else was available. It's very clear that within the economy, increasingly other things are becoming available. I very much hope that that horrible choice does not confront anyone. But if people do find themselves in a crisis, I emphasise there is advice to hand. There are other interventions to help. And what they would be, I think what they would find helpful is to go and seek that advice and that guidance.
Now, you're saying that you want to sort of get more people into jobs, but obviously there's a shortage and a sort of labour crisis in so many sectors, in tourism, hospitality, care, that sort of thing. So why is there these labour shortages when there's you say there's so many people looking for jobs as well? How is there that disparity there?
Well, I think there is a period of adjustment where people may have to be prepared to look at types of jobs which they didn't consider before. I think it's good news that we've got the market looking for employees. That's healthy. That's what we want to see. I very much hope that people who are trying to improve their economic situation, who want to benefit from improved income, improved livelihood, will actually find the opportunity to do that. But the labour market is healthy in the sense that, you know, the demand is there for jobs, and I want to make sure that people are directed towards finding jobs that suit them, because there is the opportunity to work. There's no doubt about it, and it's for people to make their own individual decisions as how they want to do that. But I am absolutely clear that with the growing economy, the jobs opportunities are there.
So there we are, the Baroness, who is much too unimportant to speculate about why a member of the House of Lords should be appointed into the UK government. There was a lot of interesting topics touched on beyond what we were speaking about earlier in that interview, not least the questions about Malcolm Offord, who is was a Conservative Party donor, who is now and was an active campaigner during the pro UK side of the independence referendum, and is now a minister in the Scotland office in place of an elected MP. Adele, Annabel Goldie defended the Prime Minister's decision to do that, and she herself is a member of the House of Lords. She even said herself, "I'm one of them," and people might well ask the question, "What's she doing there?" So, what is she doing there? What is Malcolm Offord doing there? Do you have any kind of insight into what you think this says about the party, or are we focusing on something that isn't actually an issue with people?
No, I think it absolutely is an issue with people. She said there, "I don't think it's fair for any of us to speculate on why people are there." Well, I think it absolutely is, on especially the media, but also the public, to ask why these people are there. Any Democrat would probably feel there's something wrong about people that we don't elect helping make the laws of the country. I mean, that's a whole other debate where you stand on the House of Lords as an institution. But to say that we shouldn't be questioning that, of course she would say that, because as she admitted, she is one of the people. And I think it's correct to ask questions, at least, as to whether a party donor really should have taken that spot over. I mean, I'm sure Andrew Bowie and the other MPs are asking why they've not been picked for that position. But it's not really a good look, I guess. It's that people have been accusing them of sort of cronyism and sleaze, and yeah, it's not a great look, at least.
She, while talking about the House of Lords and their position in government and it all being absolutely fine, she also segues into the idea raised by Douglas Ross, the Scottish Conservative leader, who is an MP and MSP, elected to two parliaments. He's talking up the Conservative Party's role as the party for the working people. He got into a bit of a class war with Nicola Sturgeon the other day about this whole thing. They were all desperately trying to show off their working class credentials. Annabel Goldie, on one hand, talking about how they're the party that provides the opportunities for working people, at the same time justifying, in her own words, how the universal credit lift was temporary, and now that there's all these economic opportunities presenting themselves to people. Derek, have you seen any evidence to back that up? Or, like me, have you also seen quite a lot of reporting from groups, say, Citizens Advice, about what's actually happening with people who are in work and still rely on benefits and are now seeing another little bit chipped away?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we hear all the time, is that a huge amount of that universal credit cost is taken up by people who are in work. Annabel Goldie said there that, you know, if people were, if that money's coming away and they're in crisis, they should seek guidance. I mean, I don't know what can help that. It's going to be to anybody to seek guidance if that money is getting taken off them and they're having to make that choice between heating and eating, as we keep saying. I know that I covered the issue of kind of fuel poverty, which is particularly an issue right across the north of Scotland, where a lot of people aren't on the kind of the gas grid, which makes it even worse. So I think for those people who are going to listen to that and hear us saying they should seek guidance, I mean, goodness knows what kind of guidance is going to be available to help them. And I think, I mean, I couldn't agree more with what Adele said on Malcolm Offord, to try and kind of portray yourself as a kind of party of the working class. And then meanwhile, you've got someone coming in totally unelected who failed, you know, was rejected by the electorate. I mean, it's nothing against Mr. Offord. I'm sure he'll come in and do his absolute best. But it's a system that we've got. It's not democracy, really, is it? And I think it's definitely, you know, we should feel free to question it. Absolutely. It's definitely for us to question.
I mean, it's not just all been about the Conservatives this week. I mean, you've also been looking at some interesting stories that are perhaps connected to policies that have, you know, that the Conservatives have been responsible for presiding over. One of them, of course, being Brexit. And with that has reignited the debate about how Scotland is connected with the rest of Europe. A glance over at the Republic of Ireland and you can see how ferry links to bypass the UK have been sort of growing at pace. You were looking at that, the possible restoration of direct links from Scotland to the rest of Europe this week as well. I mean, is that something that we're likely to now see because of Brexit? Better links to the continent as a strange irony.
Well, it's something that is it was a election pledge by the Scottish Greens that they were going to look at kind of bringing in, to, you know, creating a publicly owned service to continental Europe from places like Rosyth. People might remember there was previously a direct ferry link from Rosyth to a port in Belgium, but that was initially for both freight and passengers. The passenger element kind of fell off in, I think, 2010, and then the freight element continued up until 2018 before it was kind of terminated. It's something that's been looked at afresh because right now there is this, you know, as you say, looking across to Ireland, it's something that they have made quite good use of since that Brexit vote to make those links, and it seems to have been quite successful for them. It's something that Neil Hanvey, the Fife MP, and Kenny McCaskill, his Alba colleague, have been calling for this week. I think there is ongoing discussions about that at the moment. We're going to, you know, maybe point out that people should maybe keep an eye on some of our coverage over the next couple of days because we might have a little bit more on this. But I know there's been background talks. I know that the Scotland office has been involved in that process as well. I know that Douglas Chapman and a number of figures have been involved in those discussions. And it's looking positive. I mean, I think from the UK government's point of view, there is a preference to look at free ports and how that might play into this and how that might be an option to try and kind of get round some of the problems. I mean, I think the SNP's position previously was that they didn't want this to be publicly owned, that it would need to be done on a commercial basis. And I think probably a lot of the discussions are going to fall across those kind of lines. But I think there's an appetite for it. And I think, you know, looking across the water and seeing that it's been successful already, it's going to make people look at it again and think maybe it could be a good idea.
Well, yeah, as you said, it's one to watch, and we'll be having a lot more of that in print and online in the coming days. But that's it for this week. Thanks to Derek Healy and to Adele Merson and producer Morven McIntyre, and of course to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more, but until then, and even after then, pick up or log on to The Courier, The Press and Journal and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio.
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshie today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshie or follow Stooshie Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.